Who I am. I'm a former Marine Corps officer. I was an intelligence officer. I served in the 1980s, 1990s. I did arms control work in the former Soviet Union, implementing the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. I served in Desert Storm. And then I think what most people know me from is the 7 years I spent with the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq, helping oversee the disarmament of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. I resigned in August of 1998, critical of what I deemed to be the interference of the U.S. government and the work of the inspectors. And I've been speaking out critically of what I consider to be bad foreign policy, bad national security policy on the part of the United States. I'm not anti-American. I'm an American. I've worn the uniform. I've served my country. I love my country. But I think it's incumbent upon a good citizen to hold those whom we elect to higher office accountable for what they do in our name. And that's what I'm doing. That's why I'm here today. I don't have a huge social media presence. I have a Twitter account at Real Scott Ritter, and I occasionally write articles and books. And if anybody's ever interested in things like that, I'm sure a short Google will get you to those titles.
Yeah, fantastic Twitter, fantastic articles that you put out as well, Scott. And so just real quick, if
Now, I always try to listen to what the principal parties say when trying to assess what they're doing. And there's an awful lot of people out there today who, talk about Putin's playbook, the Russian playbook, as if they have a copy of it right next to them and they can flip over to page 63 and tell me exactly what's transpiring. Nobody has a copy of it except Putin and the Russian general staff, and they're not sharing it. To the extent that they do provide insight, we would do well to listen to them. For instance, in Putin's lengthy address justifying his decision to launch this special military operation, he was quite clear that this was done for the sole purpose of freeing Donbas, Luhansk, Donetsk from Ukrainian occupation, to return the totality of the territories of these two newly independent entities to their sovereign governments. But he said, if we limited it simply to this operation, there's a huge mass of Ukrainian troops that Russia believed was getting ready to attack the Donbas, and that if you didn't take them into account, then this battle will become very complicated very quickly. And you can't take them into account simply by attacking them, but you also have to understand that they are connected to the Ukrainian military as a whole. So if you limit your attack to just addressing the 60 to 100,000 Ukrainian troops that are amassed in the Donbas region, you allow the Ukrainians now operating on interior lines. That's a nice little military term, meaning that they're using their own railroads, their own roads, their own logistics system. They have their ammunition dumps already in place, and so logistically operating is very easy. And logistics is sort of the heartbeat of modern combat. If your logistics is functioning and you have well-trained troops, you're going to do pretty good in this war. And so if you just leave the Ukrainians alone, they're going to be able to bring in reinforcements. They're going to be able to bring in logistics sustainability. And they're going to disrupt your entire operation up to and including they may win because they have a larger military in the immediate vicinity than the Russians have brought to bear. So Russia had to expand the operation to nullify this Ukrainian advantage. And this, I guess, would be what's called phase one. Now, to be fair to the critics of the Russians, and Russia didn't come out and say phase one from the start. The Russians have not had a very good track record of explaining this war. They've and again, from a military perspective, they don't need to. You and I really don't need to know what's going on. The Russians don't care, but when your opponent is engaged in a massive information warfare operation that is done in concert with know, NATO members, with mainstream media, et cetera, in a very virulent social media presence, you will be on your back foot diplomatically and from public relations standpoint by ceding the information battlefield to the enemy. And the Russians pretty much have done that. So they launched an operation. It wasn't explained at all what was going on. Why did they put an airborne assault into, you know, Hostomel Field on day one? What was the purpose of that assault? What was the purpose of coming into Kyiv? Were you trying to take Kyiv? Were you trying to isolate Kyiv? What, you know, or were you creating a diversion? They didn't explain everything. They're leaving it up to speculation. Now we come to phase two, and apparently the Russians have said, no, no, what we were doing was shaping the battlefield, which from a military standpoint is absolutely what you needed to do. They needed to shape the battlefield to divert Ukrainian resources, to pin them in place, freeze them, to make sure reserves didn't go down to the east but went north, to destroy the logistics infrastructure that could sustain combat. And it appears that Russia did all of this, but we're only finding out about it after the fact. Mm-hmm. And some people are saying, well, that's just Russia, you know, redefining their objectives because they got beat so badly in phase one. And that's one of the, you know, the narratives that's out there, that Russia has suffered if not a strategic defeat, at least an operational defeat, compelling them to redefine their operation. But the operation that they're redefining sounds an awful like what President Putin said was their original objective. They are in the process of diverting significant combat power away from Kyiv, bringing it down to the Kharkov region, where they can launch an attack south from Kharkov. And they are taking the 40,000 troops that had been investing Mariupol and bringing them, and they're going to drive north. And at some point in time on the territory of Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, that northern pincer and that southern pincer are going to meet, and they're going to have surrounded 60 to 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers who will be rapidly eliminated as an effective combat fighting force. And that's going to be one of the great military victories of all time if it occurs the way that it appears to be occurring, which then, you know, again, now we come back to the information battlefield. When you're losing, when ground truth on the field of battle does not isn't reflected in your favor, what do you do if you're the side that's losing? You seek to divert attention away from the defeat that you're getting ready to suffer, and you create alternative narratives. And I think this weekend we saw one of those alternative narratives.
I understand that. Can I just, before we go on to that, though, I speak as a civilian. I mean, you talk about information war and military war, but if you're engaging in a diversion, if you're seeking to divert Ukrainian troops by concentrating them in Kyiv, do you tell them that's what you're doing? I mean, isn't it, you know, you're going to follow an operational plan. Don't you try and keep it secret to some extent? I mean, maybe I'm, you know, maybe from quite a, like that in court. But
from a, again, assuming that the Russian narrative is correct, that this was, in fact, a diversion, I believe it will be studied as one of the greatest diversions in modern military history. Because with a force of between 40 and 50,000 troops, which, by the way, is not capable of taking a city of 3.1 million. The Russians held in place significant Ukrainian military resources and captured the attention of the world. If you think about it, the mere act of putting trucks on a road that extended for 40 miles paralyzed Ukraine and the world. Every waking moment, people were looking at those trucks going, what are they doing? What are those trucks doing? Why do they have the trucks on the road? I mean, are they going to attack Kyiv? The Russians didn't have to do anything except keep the trucks there, and the diversion was complete, because that's all everybody focused on, was the trucks. Meanwhile, while the Ukrainian government's, again, reserves that are in Western Ukraine that should have been sent, while they could be sent, while the rail network is working, while you have fuel, could have been sent to the Eastern a concentration of forces to reinforce the flanks, making any eventual pincer all but impossible, had to go to Kiev or had to go down to Odessa. If you remember, big battles near Mykolaiv coming out of Kherson, big battles. And again, the Ukrainians rushed down to reinforce. So the reserves are now depleted. They're gone. There's no more reserves. They've been committed to Kiev. They've been committed to Odessa. Meanwhile, the main objective for the Russians is sitting there like a ripe apple waiting to be plucked. So, yeah you're right. I mean, the Russians don't need to come out and say, this is nothing but a grand diversion. No, they could have said, however, you know, that this is that they have an objective on Kiev. But again, they didn't need to. I mean, again, you and I would like to have them better define what they're doing. But from their perspective, the less said, the better. Because the uncertainty that is derived from a lack of information from the Russian side feeds speculation, feeds this, you know, the Western propaganda machine wondering what in the hell, actually, I don't know if I could say that. What in the heck are the Russians up to? And like I said, you know, at some point in time, this war is going to end. At some point in time, the truth is going to come out. Documents are going to be provided. And I believe that, one, we're going to see one of the great pincer envelopments in modern times. But the thing that made the pincer possible was this diversion, the Kiev diversion, which, if it is what I think it is and what it appears to be, was masterful. Now, some people say that it was a bridge too far, that this was a repeat of, you know, Arnhem back in, 1944, that the Russians were going for the coup d'etat to send these elite paratroopers into Hostomel, that they were going to reinforce them with the 73rd Air Landing Brigade that was going to make a bold thrust into a city of 3.1 million, defended by over 100,000 people, and somehow capture the government in Kiev and change. That's a wonderful story, but I don't think you'll find a single military professional that'll tell you that that was possible. And I know one thing about the Russians. They are professional, professional, professional. They're not perfect. We've seen video proof that they're not perfect, but they are professional. And I just can't imagine a situation where they would say, we're going to send, an elite airborne regiment into Kiev to be slaughtered in the streets like sheep. You know, the Russians learned this lesson once in Grozny early on in the Chechen conflict when they dispatched, armored regiments into the Chechen capital only to have them cut off and slaughtered. I don't see this modern day iteration of the Russian military making that same mistake in Kiev. So I view this as a masterful deception that will be studied by military historians for years to come as, one of the prime examples of what strategic deception is. But I could be wrong. I mean, we'll find out.
I mean, Scott, I mean, didn't your former boss, General Schwarzkopf, I mean, this is my memory again. I mean, my memory isn't particularly great, but didn't he actually position U.S. troops, further away from Kuwait so that he kept Saddam Hussein and his people guessing and all of us guessing about what he was going to do? And in fact, we discovered afterwards that it was, again, he was dispersing Iraq's forces at that time. So this isn't, it may be masterful, but it's hardly unique, and it's been done by the U.S. military itself.
It goes back into history. I mean, study Napoleonic warfare, the least deceptive combat in combat. I mean, you've got literally mass formations on the battlefield, marching in a straight line, wheeling. But Napoleonic conflict was all about feints, deceptions, diversions, fixing, flanking. I mean, all these concepts come from the Napoleonic conflict. And, Little Hart, the British grand strategist who wrote a book, a wonderful book called The Strategy of the Indirect Attack, where, basically it was, when we talk about maneuver, you don't want to maneuver straight into the main teeth of the enemy's defenses. You want to keep them fixed and maneuver around them, attack where they're not, take advantage of speed and maneuverability, etc. And what General Schwarzkopf did, and let's be honest, General Schwarzkopf didn't write that plan. I know he's commander in chief, but the plan was written actually by a group they called the Jedi Knights from the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. They actually worked on the plan there. Then they were brought to Riyadh, where they developed the plan. But there's a lot of people involved in coming up with that plan. The Marines had been looking for to be involved in a big way in terms of amphibious assault. I was part of that. I actually was on a what's called the ad hoc planning team, working directly for the Commandant of the Marine Corps to come up with major amphibious options, because the Marines are, you know, we come from the sea. And what Schwarzkopf wanted to do is take two Marine divisions and put them on the ground like they were just sort of a clone of the Army. And our feeling was, if we allow ourselves to be used in this way, in the future, the Marine Corps will only be seen as a clone of the Army. It won't be seen as the expeditionary force in readiness. So we came up with a plan to attack the Al-Faw Peninsula and put a Marine expeditionary force, a corps-sized force, over the beach to threaten a logistics center called Khor al-Zubayr, where all the logistics and command and control was. And by doing that, you had the Republican Guard up here, and we would have frozen them in place at a time when the Army then would come in, not from the Grand Sweep, but through Wadi al-Batin. Now, the Republican Guard, it would be in what we call the horns of a dilemma. Do you pivot to take care of the Marines, and by doing so, leave your positions to be attacked by air, or do you stay in place to face the Army, only to have the Marines come in the rear? So I was personally involved in that. I actually came up with the bulk of that plan and briefed it to the Commandant myself. I only bring that up not to brag, because I got rejected, but to point out that I'm intimately familiar with the strategic concepts associated with maneuvering forces. And then this was modified. The Marines instead faked amphibious assault, freezing Iraqi divisions on the coast. And the Marines conducted what's called a fixing operation against the bulk of the Iraqi army. The 1st Cavalry Division did a diversionary attack. All these concepts up Wadi al-Batin, all these things designed to freeze the Iraqi military, while the main force went around in the famous Hail Mary left hook and outflanked the entire Iraqi military and rolled them up in the great victory. We've lived this. We've done this.
This is exactly the point I wanted to make. This is exactly the point I was making at the beginning. I mean, I think European militaries no longer operate in this kind of strategic sense. So I think here in Europe, especially, we have that difficulty understanding this kind of maneuver war, because, well, how long ago is it since we ever did anything like that? I mean, in Britain, you have to go back to the 1940s since anybody really tried anything like this.
Well, I'll say one thing. Not in total disagreement. When you say try, I assume you're speaking in terms of active combat. Yeah. But NATO in the 1980s was one of the premier maneuver combined armed forces in the world. Yeah. And the German the German insistence on forward defense meant that, you know, we were putting militarily inferior forces on the border, and had the Soviets come across with their mass, our defense would have been a series of retreats, counterattacks, maneuver. I mean, it would have been the epitome of maneuver warfare, using firepower where necessary to fill in gaps, etc. All taken out of von Manstein's playbook, because we do have that playbook, unlike the Putin playbook. We've got the von Manstein playbook from 1942, 1943, 1944 on how to fight a maneuver campaign of strategic withdrawal, trading space for time so reinforcements can be flown in and we can launch the counterattack. The British had the British Army on the Rhine. They were masters at maneuver. Right. The Germans were, again, because they insisted on forward defense there. And the United States was second to none. We were, this was what we did. This is the military that I was part of. But then the collapse of the Soviet Union came, and we gave it all up. We no longer did it. And then it's not just the 20 years of the global war on terror. It's 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union that we have stopped training to carry out large-scale combined arms operations. When I was in a Marine artillery battalion for 2.5 years before I got sent to the Soviet Union, we were in the field 220, 250 days a year. This is during peacetime. And we were doing live fire exercises during 50% of that time. Live fire, maneuvering with other elements. We were training as we were going to fight. None of this, command post exercises, send one battery out to simulate, battalion. No, we were in the field with everybody fighting in as close to wartime conditions as you could get. Every year, every month, we came in only to repair our vehicles. And then we were right back out there doing it again, because that's the only way you learn, is to do it right, do it real. And we were good. We were really good. But if you stop training that way, you can't say you're good. You might have some theoretical knowledge, but when it comes time to actually practice it, you're going to make mistakes. The reason why we weren't making mistakes is because we made all the mistakes in the field. We learned that. We sat there and said, well, why couldn't we resupply on time? How come the exercise had to come to a grinding halt? Because we ran out of fuel. Do we need to come up with a new way of refueling ourselves on the move? And we did. We were innovative. Instead of, we brought the fuel trucks to the forward edge of the battle area and refueled at night on the move so we could keep sustaining the operation. We don't do that anymore. Nobody does that anymore except the Russians. Nobody fights like that. And you just can't relearn it overnight. We have a military, first of all, of NATO that has basically allowed itself to wither away into nothing. The Germans used to have multiple divisions. Today they have 12 brigades, none of which can get out of the barracks as an intact unit. Their equipment doesn't work. Their maintenance is awful. Their troops have low morale, low skill level. They just don't train. And then the United States Army today is just a shadow of its former self. We have two armored divisions now, first armored division and the first cavalry division. really? and again, we don't train as brigades or divisions or corps anymore. We train as battalions, maybe as a brigade through a command post exercise. If you don't train like you're going to fight, you're going to die. I mean, there was a book called America's First Battles. I think that's the title of it. But it just basically discussed how America tended to focus on preparing for the war they just fought, not for the war they were going to fight. And as a result, the first battles were almost always a disaster, Kasserine Pass. What happened in Korea when we sent the first units in to fight the Koreans, Vietnam. The only time we got it right was the Gulf War, because we basically took a military that had been training for the future fight, to fight the Soviets, and were experts in combined arms warfare, and we brought them down to the deserts of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and we let them do what they were trained to do. I think early on, as the Russians were making their demonstration in force, that there were major battles. I think there had to be major battles, because you had to convince the Ukrainians that this was a major fight. I mean, if all you're having is a series of tactical probes, the Ukrainians might not be so panicked into diverting the majority of their strategic reserves into the Kiev battlefield. So I do believe that early on we saw the Russians make some major pushes and suffered some serious tactical defeats as a result. They pushed hard, maybe too hard, and the Ukrainians were able to cut off some units, bring some artillery to bear. Because remember, this is early on in the battle, so the Russians hadn't totally shaped the battlefield yet. So the Ukrainians still had effective command and control. They still had effective fire support. Their units in the front lines would be able to call back, call in fire, etc. So, and then the Russians are doing the same. Let's not pretend for a second that the Ukrainians weren't taking horrific casualties. They were. These were big fights, but then things slowed down. I mean, it slowed down to molasses, the 40-mile convoy. And then after that, I think what we saw is that the Russian presence alone was sufficient to cause panic in Kiev and the response. And then when you have a static battlefield, and I think the Russians had made the decision that, If the idea was deception, they made their point early on with the aggressive thrust in. But now, you don't want to sacrifice troops needlessly. I mean, every soldier lost in early on was lost in a strategically just decision. People can criticize the tactics all they want, but from the strategic standpoint, you know, losing, you know, 300, 400 soldiers in order to pin down 120,000 Ukrainians is a strategic victory. But it's a horrible tactical defeat for the soldiers that got killed or wounded. But they're also slaughtering the Ukrainians. I mean, the Ukrainians don't want to talk about the number of casualties they've taken for obvious reasons, but they're horrific. But now the Ukrainians, again, because let's also understand something else. These aren't amateurs. The Ukrainian military is very well trained, very well led, very well equipped. And they, you know, they're professional. And all the concepts that the Russians know of strategy and tactics and operations, the Ukrainians know as well. And so I believe the Ukrainians began to launch a series of localized counterattacks. Now, the Russians have a choice. Because when I say localized counterattack, what that means is that the Ukrainians seek to achieve military superiority in a given area on the battlefield before they launch the counterattack. And now the Russians could either stay in place and lose more men for a piece of territory that no longer has strategic importance, or they can do tactical withdrawals, tactical redeployments on the battlefield. And so that's where people started talking, well, the Ukrainians are pushing the Russians back. No, the Russians were basically doing a series of tactical withdrawals. And again, if you study military history, again, World War II is a prime example of this. You study the detailed campaigns of what was going on on both the Russian side and the German side, and you'll see that the major battles were really formed by a series of minor engagements, minor probes, minor counterattacks, minor maneuvers that take place. And when you're down there looking at it, you realize you have a bunch of ants running around doing stuff. But when you pull back, all you see is a red blur. And it looks just like a static line. And there's nothing going on. But then you come back down, and them ants are going at it again. And that's the reality of the Kiev battlefield, is that from a distance, it looks static. When you look at a map, you know, you'll see one day, you know, you got a little bulge here, and the next day the bulge is gone. And you're like, oh, the Ukrainians, strategic counterattack. No, just a bunch of ants moving around on the battlefield, shifting up, getting in a better position. Yeah. And the Russians did that because they still needed to keep the Ukrainians frozen in place. Having created a diversion to suck the Ukrainian reserve in place, you now had to keep them frozen in place. So you have to keep this static maneuvering going on. But again, I think at some point in time, the grand strategists and the Russian general staff sat there and said, and the key to this was Mariupol. Was when Mariupol stopped being a major battle that required 40 to 50,000 men to do it, to a minor battle that could have 10,000 men surround a limited area and reduce it and allow the other 40,000 to be redeployed. After, again, everybody's like, well, shouldn't it happen instant? If you're in high intensity urban conflict for weeks, and now you want to pull them out and get them ready for an offense, you have to stop, you have to rest, you have to rearm, re-equip, and frankly speaking, reorient. Because if your troops now have broken down into tactical battle groups that are designed to storm buildings and hold urban terrain, and now you're pulling them out saying, we're going to launch a major open field maneuver war here, you've got to literally pull all your commanders aside from the lowly sergeant all the way up to the colonel and reorient them on the battle and actually give them a chance while they're re-equipping to maybe do a little bit of training to get their vehicles out that had been used to sneaking down a city block and now saying, nope, your vehicle's now going to be charging ahead at higher speed. We got to get back into providing covering, overwatch fire, flank protection. Okay, we got to get you all on this. This takes time. So everybody's like, well, okay, so they freed up the 40,000, but why aren't they attacking right now? That's not how war works, man. That's not how military professionals work. There's always a operational pause to refit, rest, and reorient. And that's what's happening right now. When the time's right, and the Russians will decide when the time's right. They're in control of this war. They're in control of the battle. The Ukrainians are doing nothing proactive. Everything that's happening right now is happening because the Russians are driving every aspect of this conflict. They own the timeline. The only thing the Ukrainians can do is fight harder and maybe slow things down. And they are. Again, hats off to the Ukrainian army. Hats off to them. I don't think you're going to find a single Russian soldier is going to say this was a pushover, this was a walkover. Mm-hmm. I think the Russian soldiers are going to say this is a hard fight, even if it's against the Azov battalion. You know who else fought hard? The Waffen SS. Didn't make them good people. They all died like the dogs they were, but they fought hard. Azov's fighting hard. The Ukrainian army's fighting hard. Their Marines, the real lions of Mariupol were the Ukrainian Marines. They're all dead now. The guy, they have some of their elite airborne units out there fighting right now, defending the flanks in Donbas. They're dying right now, but they're fighting hard. So hats off to the Ukrainian military. But, courage, as King Leonidas and his 300 found out, you can only stand up against the immortals for so long. Yeah. Eventually, a million arrows are going to come out of the sky and you're all going to die. That's just the reality. And that's happening to the Ukrainians right now. They have no fuel, no ammunition. Their command and control is shot. The units no longer have the ability to operate as a large cohesive force. They've been broken into smaller components that are gradually being isolated and ground down. Could the Russians go faster? Yes. But speed sometimes brings with it risk, and risk brings with it casualties. And I think right now the Russians, because they are in total control, they don't need to take risky moves. They don't need the Kiev deception anymore. They don't need to make a bold thrust at Odessa. Right now, they are in control of everything, and this is going to be a slower fight, not because the Ukrainians are fighting that hard, but the Russians just don't want to take the casualties that sometimes speed entails. It's a slower-paced fight. The Russians are in control of the battlefield, and the pincer is going to come together sooner rather than later.
If troops are withdrawn from a place like Kiev, I mean, does that affect their morale? Do they feel less confident going into battle elsewhere? Or is it something that professional troops are prepared for? I mean, this is just, again, an obvious question, but it's a question from a civilian to a military person. I mean, is it something
If troops have been defeated, there's always a morale problem. I mean, even the most hardened professionals, when defeated, it affects their elan. It affects their esprit. It doesn't mean that they can't fight, but there is a morale problem. But if troops have been given a task, and believe me, the Russians are so professional that there's no way those troops that went into Kiev didn't know they were part of a deception. They knew what their job was, especially the airborne troops. They were told, you're going to go in there and make a demonstration. You're going to come in hard. You're going to act like this. And you're going to lose some people. This is going to be a big fight. This is bad, but you got to do it. And they did it. And if you saw there, some of the most highly decorated units right now, there's award ceremonies where the Order of St. George is being given out. You don't give the Order of St. George in that number to guys who got their butts kicked. You give it to guys who did their job. Tough job, a difficult job. And you know what? The professionals, they sit there and they say, okay, we did our job, but now they're going to let the dogs loose. And Shakespeare said, cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war. Well, the Russians are getting ready to cry havoc and they're going to let loose. And now these troops that made all this sacrifice in this strategic deception are going to be turned loose. And we're talking the elite strike forces of the Russian army. We're talking the airborne infantry, and we're talking the First Guards Tank Army. I mean, the First Guards Tank Army is the premier offensive strike force of the Russian military, and it made a wonderful operational feint coming out of Sumy towards Kiev, and they suffered some losses. Not as many as the paratroopers did, but they suffered some losses. But not enough to blunt them. It's the First Guards Tank Army. And they're now going to come down and remind everybody why they have that title attached, Guards. That isn't given away. That's earned. Earned by history. And the history brings – look, I'm from the United States Marine Corps. Do you think when I graduated basic training that I was as combat capable as the Marines that fought on Iwo Jima and survived? No. But I thought I was, because I was trained to be a Marine. I had been infused with the fighting spirit of the Marine Corps, that I would never betray those who fell before me. I would never betray the honor of Iwo Jima by disgracing myself on the battlefield. That's the First Guards Tank Army. These are guys that took Berlin. They're not gonna let the Ukrainians beat them. And so I don't think the Ukrainians quite understand what's about to happen to them, because this isn't a defeated military. The Russians haven't lost anything. They're winning this. They know they're winning this. And the war's going at pace they are determining, not Ukraine. People need to put on their thinking caps. You don't blow up major fuel depots every night and suddenly expect the Ukrainian military to be this wonderful maneuvering force. No. They're in tanks that can't drive. Their tanks are static right now because there's no fuel in the tank, which means that once you get into a battle of maneuver, coffin. It's a coffin. Yeah. Same thing with their armored vehicles. The same thing with their artillery. Where's the ammunition coming from? You know, you see all those multiple rocket launchers going off. Woo, 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 and it's really dramatic and everything. But now you got to reload. Where's that stuff coming from? You need 90 trucks worth of ammo to come up and get the battalion ready. There ain't 90 trucks, because even if they have the trucks, they don't have the fuel for the trucks. And they don't have the ammo anymore because it was blown up in the ammo dump. So Ukrainians have exhausted their ability to fight. That's why right now we have a major propaganda effort underway to keep the attention of the West in place. Because believe me, the West knows what's going on. You don't think NATO intelligence understands the reality on the ground in Ukraine? They know the Ukrainian army has been defeated. They know it's over. There's nothing. Yet the Ukrainians are saying, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. Now, it'd be one thing if you looked at him and said, no, you're not going to get it. You've lost. But then they create diversions, and I'm sure we're going to talk about one of these diversions pretty soon. That enrages the West.
Yes.
Now, what is it? In addition to saying the bad Russians are evil, it's we have to give the Ukrainians everything they're asking for so they can continue this fight. I mean, how pathetic is it that you don't acknowledge, if you're going to sit there and talk about sending, I don't know, was it 50 to 70 T-72 tanks you're talking about sending in, when Ukraine had 2,000 of them, they're all gone. They're all gone. There's one or two around, but they've been destroyed, annihilated. There's nothing left. They're talking about sending in Soviet era, East German infantry fighting vehicles that have been reconverted by the Czechs on behalf of the Swedes, who no longer want them. So who knows what's going on? But why do they need those? They got nothing left. And so you honestly think that you're going to bring in 70 tanks, 150 infantry fighting vehicles, even if you can get the crews to operate, then those crews haven't trained with each other. They don't have effective command and control. They don't have fuel. And they're now going to go to the battle? Let's say you filled up the tanks. One last parting gift from the West. We filled up the tanks so you can go to the battlefield. They're all going to die before they get there, because the Russians are going to bomb them. I mean, this is the reality of the military thing, but the propaganda war is so intense that the West is going to continue to feed in these weapons. And all it's doing is prolonging the suffering of the Ukrainian people and guaranteeing that an even larger percentage of the Ukrainian army is going to die on the field of battle. There shouldn't be a need for one more Ukrainian soldier to die. They've proven their courage. They've proven they know how to fight, but they've lost. And now all we're doing is guaranteeing that, A, Ukrainian soldiers are going to die, but B, too, look at the Russians. They said up front, we don't want to harm your civilian infrastructure. But the longer this war goes on, the more Russia has to target the civilian infrastructure. That's why, if this was the United States, do you really think that the refinery that the Russians hit the other night, Kermontan or whatever, would have lasted nearly a month into the war? No, it would have been blown up on day one. Do you think that the train network that has allowed Ukrainian refugees to flee from Kharkiv and eastern Ukraine to Lviv and to Poland, that train network would have been left intact? Nope, would have been blown up on day one. You think there'd be a bridge in Ukraine today standing? No, they would have all blown up. That's what we do. That's what I did. I mean, I looked at a target, and we looked at the strategic importance of everything, and we killed it all. We blew it all up. You want military industry? It was all blown up. Civil industry, we call that dual capable, by the way, because if you can produce a car, you can produce a tank. So we blow that up too. We would have taken it all out. The Russians didn't do this. They didn't do this until now. So the longer this war goes on, the more Russia is going to be compelled to destroy that which Ukraine will need to reconstitute itself once this war is over. And the blame is solely on the Ukrainian government, solely on the Ukrainian government, not because I'm justifying the Russian incursion, but because we have to deal with reality. We have to deal with the reality as it exists today, and Ukraine cannot win this war. There's not a rational, sane person that can articulate a case for Ukraine winning this war. Therefore, everything that transpires from this moment on is nothing more than an act of futility on the part of the Ukrainian government. And it's the Ukrainian civilians that are going to pay the price, not just now, but decades from now, because their country is gone. It's finished. It's destroyed.
Scott, is there any way you can see that Ukraine might come out militarily successful from this? Because, I mean, what is the? Do they have a plan? Can they sort of come up with a plan? I mean, at this stage, because, I mean, the way you've just put it, this is now a, I mean, this is, by the way, something I've been saying for a long time on my own programs on my channel, that it looks to me a hopeless case. But I mean, is there anything they could practically do that could turn this round?
Well, first of all, let's just start with the following. I could be 100% wrong in my analysis. I could be so far off, it's not even funny. It's possible that the Russians suffered a strategic defeat outside of Kiev. It's possible that the troops that have been withdrawn from the Kiev area are combat ineffective because they have no, they're demoralized. It's possible that Russia no longer, that Russia has outrun its logistics ability to sustain this conflict, that Russia didn't prepare for a months-long combat, that they wanted this thing over in a matter of weeks, and now it's stretched on into months, and they don't have the fuel and ammunition to keep this going. It's possible that the casualties that the Russia has suffered amount to nearly 50% of their committed force, and they just don't have anything left to fight, and that the Ukrainian military, therefore, if it's simply reinforced with additional weaponry and capability, could launch the masterful counterstrokes of all masterful counterstrokes, and this is a strategic victory. And it's also possible that I smoked about 16 bongs this morning and I'm high as a kite, because that's the only way any of that is real. No, there's not a military professional out there who can look at a map and then you add it to what we know from intercepts. And again, let me talk a little bit about intercepts, because there's been a lot of propaganda out there about intercepted Russian communications. You know, you've seen it. They play the actual clip. You know, well, they're operating on frequency 1.4603 megahertz. Blah, blah, blah. They're using civilian cell phones because Russian communications doesn't work. Really? I think the Russian communications works very well. I think the Russians have some of the most secure combat tactical communications out there. I think that their communications is seamless. I also believe that the Russians have great operational security, and they understand when you use a cell phone, you're basically geolocating your own position. And if you send a TikTok home or a Instagram home or a V contact home, you're giving away operational intelligence. So I believe that every Russian formation was stood at attention, and the officers and NCOs went down and said, give me your cell phones. And then they frisked everybody down, and there's no personal communications on any Russian soldier anywhere in Ukraine. So you have to ask yourself, well, where'd they get the cell phones then? Now, the Ukrainians realized that, it's hard to explain where they got. So, they stole them from the Ukrainians. So the Russians now are going in and beating up innocent Ukrainians and stealing their cell phone. Now, I'm not, I was told that the way that, cell phones are encrypted in Europe and stuff, that it's very much point to point, that, it's basically, if I lose control of my phone, nobody can grab my phone and use it. Okay, so I just beat up a Ukrainian, and got his phone or her phone, because I'm a guy and I'm a Russian guy and I like beat up girls. So I take the girl's phone, and now I'm calling home to mommy. And nobody's stopping me, by the way. The guys in my tank who were told this is, you're going to commit suicide doing this, my officers, nobody cares. I'm calling home to mommy, and I'm whining, or worse, I'm a lieutenant calling my colonel. And I'm complaining about lack of logistics. My guys are scared. They don't know anything. Wah. It's all fake. 100% fake. We know the Russians are using comms because we've seen it. We've seen their secure comms go up. We know when you look in the tanks that have been destroyed, they have functioning tactical encryption, functioning tactical radios. They don't need cell phones. This is just part of the myth that's being created out there. No Russian soldiers calling home to mommy, not from inside Ukraine.
Scott, a question about the events over the weekend. Do professional disciplined soldiers behave in that kind of way? Do the kind of thing that has been alleged happened in Bucha? I mean, I can imagine some armies doing that sort of thing, but would a professional, trained, disciplined army controlled by officers do something like this? And what would be the object of doing it?
Well, the short answer is yes, unfortunately. We know that war is a deeply dehumanizing process, and even the most highly trained military professionals have been known to lapse. The United States Marine Corps, which I was a part of, I'm very proud of the Marines. I love the Marines. In Haditha, Iraq, launched they were patrolling IED, improvised explosive device, went off, killed some Marines. The Marines went down to the village that was where they suspected the IED had been triggered, and they proceeded to murder, rape dozens of Iraqis. It was horrible, horrible crime. But the interesting thing about that is when the investigation was done afterwards, their leaders were punished, especially junior leaders. I'm always one to believe that the senior leaders should be punished too, but the junior leaders were punished, and some of the NCOs were found to be culpable in murder. But this is the important point, the junior Marines that were involved were almost all exonerated. And you'll say, well, why? They were the trigger pullers. Because the Marine Corps, when studying this, realized that the Marines were only doing that which they were trained to do. So when a NCO says, clear the room, the Marine Corps method of clearing the room was to violently go in and kill everything without question. And it was only after that that General Mattis, when reviewing this, said, we have to retrain our Marines. We have to, what we're doing is wrong. We have to retrain our Marines. So now it comes down to training. And had the junior Marines been properly trained on how to clear a building so that you don't haphazardly kill the occupants, there might have been a different outcome, because a solid lance corporal or a solid corporal would have told the sergeant, that's an unlawful order, I refuse to carry it out. And if the sergeant insisted, would have gone to the lieutenant and said, Sergeant Schmuckatelli is trying to order me to do something bad here. Because that's what professionals do. Now, we bring it to the present. The Russian army has been told, and the reason why we know that what they've been told is being carried out is the way they've behaved. Russian military doctrine calls for the use of massive firepower on the objective to totally annihilate any threat before it, and then you overwhelm it with massed assault. Then the goal is, of course, to kill everything in front of you. Now, that's wonderful if the only thing in front of you is an armed opponent. But if there's civilians in front of you, as is the case, if you're going to be fighting a large ground war anywhere in Europe, you're going to have civilians. The civilians will pay a heavy price. And I'm going to be frank. If the civilians are there and the enemy's dug in near them, the civilians, they're going to die, and it's not a war crime. It's just not a war crime. But the Russians said up front, we're not at war with the Ukrainian civilians. That calculus may have changed, but going in, we are not at war with Ukrainian civilians. And so every soldier was briefed on how you're going to treat the Ukrainian civilians with respect and how you're going to minimize damage to civilian infrastructure. And we know this because that's what we saw. in the first weeks of the war. We saw the Russians come in very soft. Even the Ukrainians admit it. Talk to the Ukrainians. The soldiers came in. They were very polite. The soldiers, you know, the mayor, I was briefed that I could retain control, but I needed to make sure there, you know, we weren't hiding guns and stuff like that. But once they searched for weapons, I was in control of the town. I was told to keep doing my job. The civilians were told to keep living their lives. So in that, you know, commander's intent being executed nearly flawlessly by the Russian soldier, so flawlessly that the Russian soldiers are taking casualties as a result of their soft approach, means that the Russians are an extremely well-trained, well-disciplined force. And they're obeying the orders. They understand the importance of these orders. So now they're in Bukha, up north. I think that's where we're going to here. and the Bukha is a bloody battle. I mean, one only has to take a look at the videotape. You see that the airborne especially suffered great casualties in Bukha. They lost dozens of vehicles. They probably lost hundreds of men. But eventually they controlled Bukha. They controlled it for a number of weeks. The Russians have said, while we were in Bukha, we treated the Ukrainian civilians with great respect. We let them continue to have their cell phones. Imagine that. I just want people to think about this for a second. The cell phone is the ultimate conduit of intelligence. I mean, we've seen videotapes of Ukrainian children being arrested by the Ukrainian police because they took a photograph of something, put it on social media, and you know, could have been used to target, used by the Russians to target, as if the Russians need a 10-year-old's video to target. They don't have satellites. They don't have, but, you know, the logic doesn't matter. The point is, you know, the first thing you would normally do in a combat operation of this thing is just jam all communications. And then anybody who has a cell phone, you seize the cell phones. And you have every right to do so, every right. But the Russians did not do that. They told them, use your cell phones. We're not interfering with your life. Live your life. And they did things like the Russians said, look, we traded our dry goods for their dairy product. So, you know, if the soldiers wanted milk, they wanted cheese, if they wanted cream, if they wanted eggs, you know, there was a barter system where the Russians would bring in dry goods and get this. In fact, now, this is fine and dandy, except one thing. This war has become, even though the Russians came in claiming that the Ukrainians were their Slavic brothers, their cousins, and they wanted to respect this, they didn't want to harm. This war has become something different, especially from the Ukrainian standpoint. Ukrainians right now, the nationalists, I should say, who control some of the key police and military and governmental structures, have turned this into a war of hate. Where the Russian has become a subhuman, and can, you know, we saw there was a communication coming out of, I think, Dnipro or Dnipropetrovsk, where the mayor was saying, kill them all, kill them. They're subhumans, kill them all. And we've seen similar things, castrate Russian prisoners, you know, so forth and so forth. So we've seen this become a visceral war of hatred, especially from the Ukrainian side, where collaborators are killed, tortured, murdered. And we know this because we've seen that in Mariupol. We've seen it elsewhere. So now the Russians are in Bukha. They've worked out an arrangement for peaceful coexistence with the population. And now they withdraw. And the first units in are the Ukrainian National Police. But they're not National Police. They're the Azov Battalion reconfigured as the National Police. We know this. We know that the National Police absorbed a tremendous number of right-wing nationalists, neo-Nazis. And they come in, and the first videotapes out of there show a town that's been destroyed. There's a few bodies around, but not many. And the mayor is bragging about how the town is totally in control. He's got control of everything. It's done. This was March 30th, the Russians left. March 31st, the Ukrainian forces come in. On April 2nd, a videotape was released. It's a little over a minute long, and it shows a dozen or so bodies littering a street. It's a horrible video. I mean, it does, you know, it's bad, but it's, I think I talked with Alex beforehand. It's not that bad. What I mean by that is war is hell. War is hell. I can guarantee you there's worse scenes in Ukraine than what they showed on that street. That's just the way war is. Mariupol, I think, had even scenes that were more horrific than this because of the heavy fighting. But what made these bodies different is that many of them had been bound, and it looked like they had been executed. And so now the spin that's coming out is that the Russians did this. The Russians executed. Why would an army who's made so much sacrifice in defense of the commander's intent of not harming Ukrainian civilians, of not harming Ukrainian infrastructure, at the last minute throw it all away for the sake of killing 12 people? No. You know who killed them, I believe? I believe the Ukrainian National Police came in and began a program of retribution where good Ukrainian citizens pointed out Farmer Joe who dared sell the Russians eggs. Well, that's a death sentence now. You know, Miss Smith, you know, she, you know, opened up a post office that, you know, I know, but all I'm saying is anybody who is seen as collaborating or cooperating with the Russians, especially if you're a Russian speaker, it's a death sentence. I believe some of these people were just captured and shot. Some were trying to escape and were gunned down in the process of escaping once it became clear that this retribution was taking place. And that this is 100%, well, I'm going to back it off. This is 90% the fault of the Ukrainians. But the Russians have the blame too, not because they perpetrated the crime. But if you can't be so blind to the reality of the situation that you're in, not to understand what's going to happen to the people who cooperated with you, collaborated with you, and you needed to bring buses in and say, guys, we're leaving. And if you stay, we're afraid that you're going to die. So we need you to pack a suitcase, get in the bus, and we're going to resettle you. Maybe at some point you can come back here when things have calmed down. But right now we're afraid that if you stay, you're going to die. And give them at least the option of leaving. Now, maybe that option was given. Maybe we don't know. But obviously the people who died weren't given that option or disregarded that option. And paid the ultimate price. But this, there's nothing about this that makes sense. And also here, I'll leave the final thing on this one. You know, right now we're speculating. We're just spitballing. We could end the speculation right now. Right now, Karim Khan, the senior prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, is in Ukraine with an investigatory team. He claims that he's investigating allegations of war crimes. Well, guess what, Karim? There's 12 bodies up in Bucha right now. Before they get moved and tainted, why don't you pull them out and have a forensic autopsy performed on them? Because when you do, you're going to find out time of death to near certainty. And I can guarantee you that the time of death isn't going to be March 30th, anywhere near March 30th. It's probably going to be close to April 1st, April 2nd, which tells you mechanism of death. Okay, again, you're the guy. We know what units were there. There's a videotape where the Ukrainian national policeman asks his boss, hey, they're not wearing the blue band. Can I shoot them? And he gives an expletive. Yeah, hell yeah. Shoot them. And they shot him. They killed him. So mechanism of death. Where were they shot? Back of the head, back of the back, front. What killed them? Was there a sign of torture? Was there, you know, had the bodies been moved? Did they die where they were at? Or had they been moved? I mean, normally when you're shot and you bleed out, there's going to be a big puddle of blood. But if you got a body on the ground and you flip it over and there ain't no blood, it tells me they were died somewhere else and brought here. These are things that a forensic investigation would show. And that forensic investigation can happen right now. Right now, they're there and they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
Why? Because the Ukrainian government doesn't want the truth.
Yeah,
because if the truth comes out, you don't get all this wild speculation. You don't get the whole world foaming at the mouth. You don't get the Pope condemning the Russians. Well, thank you. No, I wasn't a cop or anything like that. But for 7 years, I ran forensic investigations in Iraq, where we wrote the book. on forensic reconstruction of events. And the Ukrainians and their supporters in the West are off book right now. This is purely a propaganda exercise. It's nothing more.
I completely agree. Scott, we've had a number of questions, and there were two questions which I consider related. Firstly, that affair of the helicopter attack on the oil refinery in Belgorod, and then also the helicopter, the attempt to send helicopters into Mariupol. And what do you think about both of those things? I mean, I'm going to make my first observation. The Belgorod thing I can completely understand. And I have to say, I thought that was an extraordinarily daring and successful operation. And I'm at a loss to understand, complete loss to understand, why the Ukrainians, who have fully entitlement to bragging rights over it, are denying that they had anything to do with it. I mean, I just don't understand that at all. As to the Mariupol thing, I don't understand that operation, since, again, to my completely untutored eyes, I would have thought that sending helicopters into Mariupol at this time is to send brave men to their deaths in what is, frankly, practically a suicide mission. Any thoughts about either of these operations, Scott?
Well, the first one, the Belgorod operation, you know, one, the Russians have acknowledged that it happened. They've given credit to the Ukrainians. Some people called a false flag. No, first of all, the false flag has to achieve some sort of strategic, strategic goal, strategic objective. And the only thing this one could have done is give the Russians an excuse not to participate in, the ongoing diplomatic talks. By saying that the Ukrainians were operating in bad faith. But Russia's not participating in these talks. I mean, they're present. But anybody who thinks that these are negotiation, they just don't understand what the truth is. The Russians are there. The purpose of the talks is to give the Ukrainians the belief that they can influence the outcome, that they are players, because you need the same negotiating team to eventually surrender. And so you don't want to cut them off. You don't want to stop this process, especially for what? A minor tactical victory. They hit some civilian fuel tanks. It had no impact on the battlefield whatsoever. It was daring, though. I mean, look, and frankly speaking, this is the kind of information warfare that's 100% legitimate. I mean, if I were the Ukrainians, I was going, hey, we've been told by the Russians they control the skies. They control it. You don't control anything. We can hit you at any time we want to. We're coming at the night. We're the night stalkers, baby. We own the night. You know, we're the midnight special. We're going to shine a light on you, whatever you want to say. You know, I'd be saying this all day long, because now the Russians have to redouble their air defense. They're going to have to put a whole bunch of effort into identifying gaps, because the midnight special is coming back. They're going to shine a light on us. Oh, my goodness, we can't do this. That's how I'd be running this thing. It appears, though, that this might have been a rogue operation that was done without permission of the Ukrainian leadership, and that the Ukrainian leadership may not have wanted to kick the bee's nest, so to speak, you know, attack Russia directly, as they have every right to do. I mean, if I were the Ukrainians, I'd be doing deep operations. I'd be going and blowing crap stuff up all over the place. You know, killing Russians on Russian soil, Russian soldiers. I'd be making the Russians scared to death of that there is no safety in the rear area. I'd be blowing up depots. I'd be hitting guys in barracks. I'd be doing all sorts of stuff to disrupt their operations. But the Ukrainians aren't. I don't know it's whether the lack of capacity or a lack of will. But what it appears here is that the U.S. government has provided some very, very specific intelligence on radar gaps in the Russian air defense, and that the Ukrainians have some pilots who are skilled at night vision goggle low level flight. That's the most difficult helicopter flight you can imagine. We have a regiment that specializes in the U.S. Army, the 160th, and these guys spend years learning how to fly. So whoever flew these missions were really, really, really good pilots. And this may have been a rogue operation, which is why the Ukrainian government's not taking credit for it. But it's a real operation. And again, hats off to the Ukrainians. Hats off to you. I mean, come on, man. That is, it doesn't matter. You know, even if you were 100% pro-Russian on this one, you got to go, yeah, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, you know, you guys, okay, we're gonna get you next time, but yeah, you got us that one. That's a good one. Good on you. I mean, you got to admire professionalism when you see it. You know, and that was a very professional strike. Now we come to the opposite end of the spectrum. We go from professional strike, where risk management was you know, it was a very risky thing, but you know, it wasn't suicidal to go into Belgrade. Going into Mariupol is suicidal. I mean, it's literally an act of desperation. So you have to ask yourself, why would they do this? What was the purpose? Was the purpose to withdraw senior Azov leadership, as some people have suggested? Or was there something else at play? And now we get into the realm of somewhat conspiracy theory, but there have been some credible discussions that the French had some high-level assets in Mariupol, intelligence officers. Why they're there and what they're doing, it might be something France doesn't want to, doesn't want to admit. But, these helicopters went in, and according to a couple accounts, and again, I'd say this is pure speculation. I haven't seen, the Russian government hasn't come out and confirmed this, but the helicopter was shot down over ground, contained two bodies of two French intelligence officers. A helicopter crashed into the ocean. I don't know what the status is of that. The one that crashed on the ground, I guess there's a couple of survivors too, so they can be interrogated once they're able and to find out what exactly was going on, what was the purpose of this mission. But that mission has all the earmarks of not a well thought out, bold, military operation, but an act of desperation, literal act of desperation that may have been pushed onto the Ukrainians by the French government. Because we know that Macron was desperate to get a relief column into Mariupol to withdraw something. Desperate enough to call Putin himself. So, why the French president now is suddenly, going to put the full weight of his office on what, a humanitarian? Mm-hmm. What, they have some nuns there they're worried about? No, this seems to be something different. Not just the fact that you care about the lives of whatever intelligence assets you may or may not have had there, but also you are trying to spare yourself the embarrassment of having to explain to the world what these guys were doing there. And I think Russia has gathered this information. I believe Russia has all the answers. Russia has the names. Russia probably knows exactly what they were doing, who they were working with. And, if the time comes for them to release that information, they will. But I also think that this is a card that Putin can hold against Macron.
Yeah.
And the longer he's silent, the more uncomfortable Macron gets. So.
Scott, there's been some questions about how good you think the Russian intelligence.
Let's start with intelligence. We know that the Russians have penetrated Ukraine from an intelligence perspective in a way that most nations could only dream of. You start off with the fact that Ukraine was a former Soviet republic, and many of the Ukrainian officials were at one time Soviet officials and therefore controlled by the KGB in Moscow. They had the penetration. Now, the Soviet / Russian intelligence that I'm familiar with are some of the most risk averse people in the world. Everything's done by the book. They cross their T's, they dot their I's, and if anything, they go too slow. They're not one to make broad sweeping assertions of capability when that capability doesn't exist. But they are also a human, and they have the tendency to rely on that which they perceive is going well for them, over rely on it. You like to create a balance. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. And my feeling is that the human intelligence penetration of Ukraine by Russia was to a level that even the Russians might have been surprised. And the reason why I say this is it appears that there has been some impact on high-level FSB personnel because of this war, that there's some dissatisfaction. And some of the people that have been named are people that would have been associated with the conduct of pre-conflict intelligence preparation of the battlefield. The Russians seem to be operating under the perception that they would be received by a welcoming committee, so to speak, of pro-Russian politicians and a compliant civilian population that, if not cheering them on, at least wouldn't get in the way, and that this was that military plans were made based upon these operating assumptions that turned out to be false. There wasn't, and now we come to the other thing. As good as the Russians are, understand that since 2005, maybe even before that, CIA and MI6 have had an extensive presence in Ukraine, working with Ukrainian intelligence. And then since 2015, they've operationalized this. And we'll get into more of that when we talk about counterinsurgency. But, you know, so for every Russian human intelligence operation, there's a Ukrainian counterintelligence operation taking place, backed by the full weight of the CIA and MI6, who are bringing in their own capabilities to advise and assist. And I think, again, that, you know, it may take a long time for this book to be written, but there's one hell of a spy story in here about how the Russians were trying to prepare the battlefield. Now the Ukrainians were identifying, people who were cooperating and then turning them so that they gave false information, that the Russians failed to do the appropriate checks and balances, their due diligence to ensure that the information they're getting was good, and that the Russians got taken in. I think the Russians lost the intelligence battle in terms of how the Ukrainian people were going to receive them, especially the Russian-speaking population. I think there was some overconfidence on the part of the Russians that was derived from inaccurate intelligence assessments that were born out of a human intelligence collection plan that may have been compromised fundamentally by the Ukrainians and by the CIA and MI6. But I also believe that the Russians have near perfect intelligence on Ukrainian order of battle, Ukrainian command and control. I think there's no such thing as secure comms in Ukraine anymore. And you know, one of the reasons why I think also this is happening is look at what the Russians have done in terms of Ukrainian communications capability. Again, one of the first targets I would hit is every communications tower in Kyiv, every underground comms node, anything with a high speed data transmission capability would have all been struck on day one. I would have shut that down. I would have made them go totally black. And that didn't happen. Just the opposite. We have, Zelensky able to give live video conferences to U.S. Congress, to the British Parliament. So again, and if you think about it, that's only to Ukraine's benefit. I mean, literally every time Zelensky spoke, hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment came flowing his direction. And you have to sit there and go, what is Russia up to? Why are you doing this? Because they want it to happen. Because they don't care about the equipment. What it appears to me that what they're doing is playing a masterful game of taking a failed president who is at 23% and dropping, a man who was totally compromised by selling out to the neo-Nazis, a man who was reduced to arresting his political opposition and shutting down his opposition media, who in no way could be sold to anybody as a democratic leader of any stature. So if you shut everything down at the beginning, that's who Zelensky is, failed president. So now if you want to get him to surrender, people are going to kill him if they're Azov, or ignore him if they're the West. They're going to create a government in exile that will speak on behalf of anybody, because Zelensky is useless. So the Russians have said, no. We need Zelensky to certify the terms of surrender. But in order to do that, we have to allow the West to turn him into Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, whatever we want to call this failed comedian. He's now going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. So let him communicate. Let everything happen. Leave the train running without hindrance so idiots from Europe can come and visit him in Kiev if they want to. We're going to turn this guy into the greatest thing in the world. So when he speaks, the world listens and the world acts. And then when the time comes and he signs the surrender documents, the world has to say, he's the legitimate leader of Ukraine, and we have to respect his wishes. So that's, I see a lot of that going on as well.
Well, what about the insurgency issue?
Oh, the insurgency.
I mean, do you think there's any?
The Russians have a very, very, very good domestic policing capability. I'm not proud of that as a pro-democracy person, because I think that that ability is used oftentimes to shut down legitimate dissent. But the Russians are masters at monitoring the communications of dissenting voices. And an insurgency is the ultimate form of a dissenting voice. It's taking the weaponization of words and turning it into actual violence. Now, the insurgency can come from two sources. Three, I would say. First one is pre-planned insurgency. And we saw evidence that at least the West was claiming that it was creating this capability. When you had media reports come out of that Barack Obama back in 2015 authorized the CIA Special Activities Division to carry out a covert program of training select Ukrainian intelligence and special operations and military personnel for stay-behind operations in unconventional warfare, up to and including on Russian soil. And that's these people were taken out of Ukraine to the United States, taken down to a undisclosed training facility in the southern United States, where they crawled around and learned how to kill and all this stuff. And then they were sent back to wait for their moment in time. Problem with this story is, if we know about it, it ain't secret. There's just nothing secret about it. We're talking about it. You and I are talking about it right now, and we're not just making it up. We're not speculating. There's a story that cites five former CIA officials in a position to know. Now, when I was in the intelligence business, human intelligence and covert action of this nature was some of the most highly protected intelligence imaginable. Why? Because if it's compromised, lives get lost. It's not just like compromising a $1 billion satellite. That's just money. Like compromising a program like this, lives will be lost. So it's highly classified information that will never be declassified to the point that it can be released to the public, ever. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that the 25-year mandatory declassification laws that exist, this is the stuff that falls into that exception that says this will never be discussed. But if this was a real program, those documents will be hidden in the vault of the CIA for over 100 years before somebody finally writes about it. That's just fact. So why are five CIA people committing treason? Because that's what they're committing. It's not just espionage, they're committing treason. And I also have to say that the number of people that would be in the know of this program is limited. So now we have five. I can guarantee you that any concerted counterintelligence investigation would identify some of those five, track them down, and get them to confess before they go to jail for the rest of their lives. Because the alternative is the electric chair, because you committed treason. But nothing's happening, which tells you that this is just BS. It's garbage. This is a propaganda ploy. This is to create perception of an insurgency capability so that Russia diverts resources to hunt shadows, to hunt phantoms, to hunt ghosts. So there's that. I don't think that's real, because I don't think five CIA people would have. And again, the people I know in the CIA, I may disagree with, you know, their conclusions. I may disagree with their tactics. I may disagree with just about everything, but I will never doubt their patriotism. These are some of the most patriotic people imaginable. They love their country. They don't, you know, this is why when a CIA officer defects or is caught spying, it's such a heavy blow, because the CIA, you know, is an organization that prides itself in having some of the most loyal people working for it, people who are assiduous about obeying, you know, rules regarding classification and information security. So suddenly that five senior CIA people disregard all that, throw it away so they can get a newspaper article that does nothing more than expose a top secret covert action program, the exposure of which will probably cost people their lives. No, it doesn't pass the smell test. The next thing is the military aspect of it. What I mean by that is you have highly trained military personnel who are going to be defeated in battle, and they can't carry out the conventional resistance. So they melt into the woods and they become modern day partisans. And this could be especially true with people like airborne forces or special forces who are trained in that kind of irregular conflict. And there's no doubt in my mind that this will happen, that there will be those amongst the Ukrainians who will refuse to surrender when the time comes, who will insist on carrying the fight. They won't respect the decision made by the top, and they'll continue to fight. And they will fight effectively. They will kill hundreds of Russians, and then they will all die, because that's what happens when you're an isolated insurgency force in the middle of a forest that's going to be surrounded by Russians, and they're going to come in and kill you all. If you try and embed yourself in a urban area, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to sustain meaningful resistance, especially with a police force that is as effective as the Russians are. And now we come up to the third one, which is the citizens' revolt. You know, all these well-armed citizens with their Molotov cocktails and stuff. They are the personification of amateurs. Amateurs never live. They always die because they don't know what they're doing. They're not trained. They don't know how to do covert communication. They don't know how to do deception. They don't know anything. They're just going to go out there and think they can throw a bottle full of jellied gasoline with a rag that's been lit on fire at a tank, and that's wonderful. And they may hit the tank, but then they're going to die. And everybody involved, they'll just get rounded up and they'll get slaughtered. So now I come to the conclusion. There will be no viable insurgency against Russia, period. First of all, because of the way this war is going, if there's going to be a geographical dismemberment of Ukraine, I can guarantee you, and I'll put my reputation on, the Ukrainian population is going to be evicted. They're going to go to whatever Ukraine is, but there won't be a large Ukrainian-speaking population left. The Russians won't allow it. So all that will be left is the pro-Russian crowd, and I don't think Russia will have a problem with this, but I just don't see Russia. I don't see Ukrainians wanting to live in territories controlled by Russia, and I don't see Russia wanting Ukrainians who are hostile to them living there. So I think we're going to see ethnic cleansing along the lines of what we saw with the Serbs in Croatia back in 1994, 1995, when the Croatians said, hey, we got 500,000 Serbs living on our soil who don't like us, and we have to get rid of them. And the U.S. greenlighted a military campaign that literally pushed 500,000 Serbs out of Croatian territory into Serbia. So we know that Europe is okay with this because they've already done it. So I think that's probably what we're going to see is the physical separation of the Ukrainians who could have served as the kernel, so to speak, of a resistance organization. They're going to be removed from the problem altogether. You got to look at it from the four corners of the conflict itself, but then you have to put it into the context in which this conflict was initiated, because you can't ignore that. And then you also have to take into account the consequences of the conflict. You can't ignore that either. So the first thing is Russia has set forth two military objectives and one political objective. two politically. The first political objective, of course, is the return of sovereign control of Donetsk and Lugansk to the newly independent states of Donetsk and Lugansk. Another one is recognition by Crimea of Ukraine of the Russian control of Crimea. But these are side things. The big political objective is Ukrainian neutrality. That's ultimately why this war was fought, to achieve Ukrainian neutrality. And to do that, you need two things. You need denazification and demilitarization. Demilitarization is simply, it was initially just deconstructing the NATO architecture that exists in the Ukrainian military, that the Ukrainian military could stay intact, but it would just basically the NATO infrastructure would be taken down. The Ukrainian military has decided to fight, so I think now demilitarization means literally there will be no more Ukrainian military. If something's going to exist down the road, it'll be built from the ground up. But do svidaniya, Ukrainian armed forces. Your day is over. And so the war doesn't end until they're destroyed. I think that's just clear. Because you can't leave them. The history says so. All we have to do is take a look at World War I and what happened to the German army that was fighting in France when the surrender came in. They didn't believe they were defeated. They called it the stab in the back, and they withdrew back to Germany, and you created the conditions for World War II. I mean, it just led to the revival of German militarism. If you don't destroy the Ukrainian military, all you're doing is creating the conditions for the revival of Ukrainian militarism. And then you have to marry that with the other thing, denazification. And denazification isn't just about killing every member of the Azov battalion or every other national military formation. It is delegitimizing the ideology of the right sector, of the nationalist parties, making sure that the odious ideology of Stepan Bandera is no longer mainstreamed. So it's about passing laws that ban this. It's about the physical dismemberment of political parties and the arrest and holding to account political leaders who impose this ideology on Ukraine, therefore providing ideological impetus for Azov to commit the crimes they are committing. That's denazification. Why do I believe that's that? Because the Russians know denazification. They've denazified before. They understand what's needed. It's not just about getting rid of the Waffen SS. It's about pulling every single Nazi bureaucrat out into court and then hanging them by the neck until dead if they're found guilty of promoting this kind of conflict. So I don't believe Russia can accomplish that without going west. I don't think this war ends until Lvov has been dismembered. And so this could be a longer conflict than anybody thinks. I could be wrong. Maybe Russia wants to do all this, but maybe they don't have the ability to. Maybe, they're after they close the pincers, they won't. But I think when they close the pincers, you're going to see a new reality. Remember, there are no strategic reserves left in Ukraine. They were all sucked up into Kiev, and they're staying in Kiev right now. They've tried to move some brigades down, and they're getting destroyed. They move out of Kiev. They get on the railroads, and they get blown up. They're losing everything. Anything that moves from Kiev to the east is killed. So the Russians, when they close this gap, and when you have 70,000 Ukrainian soldiers paraded through the streets of Mariupol with their hands on their heads, in a repeat of what they did to the Nazis in 1943 through Moscow, the Russian military is now going to be moving into a giant vacuum because there's nothing left. And as they move towards Lvov, the resistance won't be what anybody thinks. It's going to be over that quick. You're going to see people fleeing to Poland, the nationalists especially. And you're going to see, I think Lvov is going to fall before Kiev does. I think Kiev will be surrounded. It's down to 2 million, but you don't want to go into Kiev. Kiev is a historical city. You don't want to live, and you really don't want to go into Lvov, but you're going to go into Lvov because you have to blow up the statue of Stepan Bandera. You want to denazify, that statue's got to go boom in a dramatic way, the way we blew up the swastikas in Nuremberg. That statue's got to go boom in one of the great defining propaganda moments in modern Russian history. And then you're going to rename the streets, and you're going to get rid of any mention of this guy. You're going to make it illegal even to think his name. And that's denazification. So I see that happening. The ultimate objective, though, is that whatever's left of Ukraine, and I don't know how much geographic dismemberment is going to be taking place. You know, I have said, you know, just totally from the perspective of an observer, I don't understand how Mariupol could ever be Ukrainian again.
Yeah.
So I think that at a minimum, there's going to be additional dismemberment that goes beyond simply the Donbas. I think Mariupol is going to be included, maybe as part of Donetsk, maybe as part of a new Novaya Russia that includes Odessa. I don't know. But I do think there's going to be a significant geographic dismemberment of Ukraine. Where that ends, I don't know. I mean, if I were the Russians, I wouldn't be against, once I get rid of all the Stepan Bandera people and blow up the statue, turning Western Ukraine over to Poland. Because you know who doesn't like Stepan Bandera? The Poles. So if you want to ensure that this odious ideology doesn't resurrect its ugly head, give it to the Poles. That's additional thing. I don't think the Poles are going to do that, because now we're into turning your back on decades of Europe saying that these borders are permanent. We don't change borders. And if Poland takes over Western Ukraine, what's to stop the Germans from saying maybe Silesia should be ours again? So you don't want, you know, you don't want to get the Germans thinking about marching east, especially at the time when the Germans are talking about spending $100 billion to rebuild their infinite military. So, so you have this, but then we have Russia's strategic objective laid out in December of 2021. That is a new European security framework. And Ukraine is just part and parcel of it. Ukraine is establishing a new reality. That reality is that NATO isn't what NATO thinks it is. And Russia's making that point right now. You're just not what you think you are. And NATO's recognizing that. NATO knows. I mean, Biden can fly to Warsaw, and the Warsaw president, Biden, can get up there and talk. Biden can talk about a sacred obligation of, you know, Article 5 and all that. Read Article 5. There's nothing sacred about Article 5. It's not dogma. It doesn't say you must send all your military instantly to the point of contact when they're invaded. It says if you're attacked, all NATO members must consider this, consult on it, and if they want to, respond. And the response doesn't have to be military in nature. So right off the bat, every NATO member has the authority to opt out. It's not attack against one, it's attack against all. It's an attack against one, and who's going to respond? And NATO is fundamentally broke right now. So if Poland picks a fight with Russia and the First Guards tank army drives on Warsaw, who's coming to their assistance?
Yeah.
Jan Stoltenberg's going to personally lead the four mobile battle groups that they've deployed there. That's 5,000-7,000 troops. They're all going to die. NATO is being exposed as this impotent, useless organization that's fracturing as we speak. By the way, Hungary is not a functioning member of NATO anymore. Turkey ceased being a functioning member of NATO a long time ago. Bulgaria is having questions. Slovakia and Slovenia are having questions. So, you know, even Germany is not going to be as hard fast as they thought they were. But the fact of the matter is, there's going to be a new European security framework that's going to have to be discussed. NATO thinks it's going to be about deploying new forces onto the eastern flank. But now we come into the other reality. Who's paying for that? General Walters, the commander of U.S. forces in Europe, testified for the U.S. Congress last week. And it was an interesting conversation, because one would think, given the current political nature of this crisis, that he would have said, we are preparing to send two corps of heavy U.S. armored forces to Europe, and we're going to show those darn Russians who the boss is. But he said, we won't know what we're going to do until after Ukraine is finished and we fully assess the new reality. And then if we are going to send new forces in, we need someone to invite us. And that's a political problem for that European nation. And then they got to pay for it, because we ain't paying for it. So now you're telling Germany, what you want, Poland, let's say, Poland, you want Fifth Corps to resurrect itself and come back with all of its might and glory from the Cold War? Let's see, it cost you almost $2 billion to put together the prepositioned stocks for one brigade. Okay, Fifth Corps is going to be maybe nine brigades. If you got $18 billion, And then it's going to cost you about $2 or $3 billion a year to sustain them. You got that kind of money? And do you have that kind of money in the aftermath of the economic recession that's going to hit you because you signed on to Joe Biden's sanction plan and it's backfired in a big way? The only people getting hurt, it ain't the Russians. The Russians, a little inconvenience, their stores are full.
Yeah.
I mean, you had that one little propaganda clip of sugar. That problem's been solved. Their stores are full. They may not be filled with brand name Western stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't need it. They got food. It's there. The Russians are not going hungry. Not only that, their ruble didn't collapse. Imagine that. It didn't collapse. The ruble regained all of its strength. And their markets are booming. Markets are booming, up 4% on Friday, climbing. The Russian economy is doing okay. Not perfect, but okay. Guess who's not doing okay? Germans. They got no food now. They're going to double the price of all the food in their shelves. I don't know what's going on in England. But they have the BASF is going to lose 40,000 jobs because they have to shut down the factory because they can't keep it open. And that's going to be followed by every single major German enterprise. Germany's done, finished, kaput. Yeah. And that means that is Germany going to be able to, A, spend $100 billion to rebuild its military? And B, I like the dog. And B, I got one right here, so I understand what's going on here. Mine's just not big enough to show his tail. But B, is Germany able to not just spend the $100 billion, but is Germany even going to be able to survive?
Yeah.
There's going to be bigger issues than what Russia did to Ukraine. And I think at some point in time, Europe's going to wake up to the fact that maybe accepting a new security framework with Russia that de-emphasizes military conflict is the way to go. Maybe we should pull NATO infrastructure back to its 1997 levels. That doesn't mean that all the new members aren't NATO members. They are. It just means that there won't be any, British tanks, German tanks, French tanks, American tanks there. All that's pulled back. There won't be any more missile defense sites in Poland and Romania. And Russia then can sit there and say, and we'll pull our stuff back to the Western military district, and we'll de-emphasize the military, the potential for military and military conflict. There's that. So I think that's something that plays how you would say, how does this conflict end? That is an extension of this conflict. And the other one is the Russian decoupling from the West. The West made a fatal mistake in declaring economic war on Russia. See, the West had far more control over Russian, what happened in Russia if they had just left the Russian economy entwined, intertangled with the West. With all these Western companies there, with all the Russians invested in the West, et cetera, with the oligarchs. I mean, the biggest nightmare for Putin are the oligarch, is the oligarch class. What to do with them? They're so rich, they're so powerful, and their wealth comes from the relationships they have with the West. And what has the West done? They've neutered the oligarchs. The oligarchs have no more power. They lost all their money, and therefore they lost any political influence they have, so Putin doesn't care about them. He gave a speech the other day. He said, go, leave, get out of here. We don't want you anymore. Go to your wealth. We're done with you. Wow, that's liberating Putin there politically. And they disenfranchised an important segment of the Russian electorate, some 20%, who were middle-class voters who were married to the West. Now, had Putin tried to divorce them, there would have been a political backlash.
Yeah.
Because the West did the divorce, Putin's hand-free, and you see it, 83% support.
Yes.
83%. He was 68% when the war started. He's 83% now, and it's going to climb because the lesson of sanctions is the more you sanction, the more popular the leader becomes because the less popular the people who are doing the sanctioning are. So that has to be taken into account, this grand pivot east, the new relationship with China, the end of the rules-based world order that the United States has been promulgating, the birth of a law-based international order that China and Russia are pushing. And also now as we watch the European economy tank, guess who's going to start flourishing? Not just Russia and China, but what they call the Eurasian Economic Union. We're going to see a huge geopolitical gravitation as the economic center of the world leaves London, leaves France, leaves Germany, and starts moving its way over eastward. Because Russia and China, together with the Eurasian nations, India, they're done with the West. They're done. I mean, they the West exists, and you'll do. But the day that the West, the day of the United States using the dollar to dominate the world is finished. It's over. The U.S. overplayed its hand. It's one of the great strategic mistakes of all time. And this is also going to play into effect. So Ukraine isn't just what's happening in Ukraine. Ukraine is what's happening in Europe and what's happening in the world, what's happening in Russia. And that's why I say anybody who thinks that Russia is simply going to stop this operation and negotiate itself into defeat, into a position of weakness, doesn't understand the big picture. Because this is so much more than just Ukraine. This is about the future of European security. If Russia surrenders in the negotiating table, they have no leverage when they talk about the future of European security. If Russia surrenders in the negotiating table, Putin loses all the political advantages gained by having the West orchestrate this defeat, this divorce. And if he surrenders on the negotiating table, the great transition to a trans-Eurasian economic future of multipolarity is over. So I don't see the Russians negotiating anything away. I see them basically, they're going to confront Zelensky with an awful reality, and Zelensky's going to have to decide how he's going to deal with that reality. It may cost Zelensky his life. I think the Russians are not going to undertake an operation that will result in after the encirclement battle. I think it's all in on the encirclement battle. I think this is a life and death struggle, and so Russia will do what needs to be done to win this battle. But after that point, once you destroy the bulk of the Ukrainian military, you'll have some pockets left over. You'll have a pocket in Kharkov. You'll have a pocket in Kiev. You'll have a pocket around Lviv, and you'll have a pocket down in Odessa. And I think what the Russians will do is try to create the inevitability of the demise of these forces to compel a surrender, as opposed to turn Odessa into a larger version of Mariupol. Mariupol was a tragic necessity. Russia had to take the city, for to establish a solid line of communication connecting Crimea with southern Russia. Plus, from a symbolic standpoint, this was the defeat of the Azov Battalion. That was their home base. This is where they were at. And fortunately for Russia, the Azov people provided Russia with around 15,000 martyrs that Russia could send to whatever the Valkyrie god, Nordic god that these Nazis worshipped. They're dead. There might be a few of them still dug out in the steel factory, but they're dead. But Russia doesn't want to do that again. First of all, Russia suffers loss. You don't fight that kind of fight without, taking losses yourself. It's a very bloody, difficult fight. Civilians get killed by the hundreds, if not thousands. So I don't imagine Russia's, licking its lips to go into Odessa. What we see right now are strikes that are designed to lessen the ability of Odessa to survive if it had been brought under siege. I think they hit the oil, the fuel storage areas. So, there's no more fuel for Odessa. It's gone. They might have a couple of caches here and there, but, Russia has drones flying over. They'll see the fuel truck go into warehouse A, and then warehouse A will get hit by caliber missile B, and that's more fuel that's gone. And just after a while, you're just going to grind them down. And eventually, they'll have no choice but to surrender. And I think that's the goal of the Russians. Now, let's say Odessa is the last holdout and everything else has happened. They've taken Lviv. They've blown up Stepan Bandera's statue. Kiev has surrendered, but Odessa's standing. Then I see Russia repeating Mariupol. The Russians, this is to their it speaks well of them, but speaks ill of them at the same time. They don't bluff. They don't bluff. So I don't see the Russians saying, "No, we were just kidding. we don't want Odessa." No, they want Odessa, and they're going to take Odessa. Now, they can take it the easy way, or they can take it the hard way, but they're going to take Odessa. That's what I think, and I'm hoping that the Ukrainians will understand that the easy way is a solution. Right now, they're feeling confident. They've received enough reinforcements. They were able to launch some of those tactical counterattacks that we spoke of, where it made them look strong, but actually all it did is suck troops and resources into that area, who are now trapped. They can't leave. If they try to leave, they get blown up. So, at some point in time, the military man's got to look around and say, well, we got 400 tanks, but we don't have any gas. So we don't have 400 tanks. We got, 600 artillery pieces, but we don't have any ammunition. So we don't have 600 artillery pieces. And what we do have is, a couple million civilians. And I'm not going to let them die. So we're going to surrender.
Yeah.
Whatever right wing group is operating in Odessa will probably take umbrage at that. They've proven that they're willing to die in glory, they think. But, I don't see, and maybe this is just wishful thinking on my part, but I just don't see Odessa becoming Mariupol. I see common sense prevailing, but it will become Russian. One thing just to add about Odessa, too, when we talk about denazification, the West has largely ignored this. But in, I think, May of 2014, the right-wing nationalists came down and stuffed the House of Culture with 150 pro-Russian demonstrators and then set the building on fire. Between 40 and 50 people killed as a result. And the Russians have viewed this as one of the great crimes. And Russia has made it a point that we have all the names. We have all the names. We know who did this. They will be brought to justice. And again, Russia doesn't make statements like this and then walk away. So Odessa will be captured. There will be trials, and those perpetrators will be brought to justice in Odessa. In Odessa, not somewhere else, in Odessa. And they'll be hung by the neck until dead in Odessa for committing the crimes that they've committed. So that's another reason why I think the Russians, this isn't over till they have Odessa, because one of the major, the major crimes against the Russian speaking population was perpetrated in Odessa. Okay. One last thing on Odessa too.
Yeah.
Because we get into, remember we talked about the different things. Yeah. You got the Ukrainian thing, then you got the European security framework. You take Odessa and you deny Ukraine access to the sea, which not only denies Ukraine access to the sea, but it strengthens Russia's position in the Black Sea. You still have, the Romanian coast, the Bulgarian coast, you have the Turkish coast, but then all that's left now is Russia. It just weakens. For instance, Great Britain gets kicks, apparently, sailing destroyers off the coast of Crimea. They won't be able to do that after this, because it'll be undisputed Russian territory, and the British ship will be sunk. And that's the other thing I think people need to understand. Russia's played the military card. There's no hesitation. If Britain wants to lose 150, 200 sailors, try sailing one of your ships over across the Crimea coast. Russia's already warned you. The next time it happened, your ship will be sunk. And it's not an Article 5 thing. That's just Britain being stupid. And I think the Russians are going to assert their dominance over the Black Sea. That's been a nightmare for them. The freedom of navigation, the freedom of movement of NATO-affiliated ships. By losing Odessa, by Ukraine losing all access to the Black Sea, it strengthens Russia's geopolitical posture in the region. And that, when we talk about this new European security framework, that's definitely one of the things.
We end this live stream. Can you just weigh in real quick for a couple of minutes on China, Taiwan, and the Solomon Islands, if you can, if you have any opinion to that?
Well, I will say, and this is just my opinion, it was a very difficult decision for Russia to pull the trigger on Ukraine.
Yeah.
This was not a decision taken lightly. And they were pushed in that direction by NATO expansion by the West. China has been observing what the West has been doing to Russia on the issue of Ukraine and recognizing there, but for the grace of God, go I, if Russia hadn't done Ukraine and had walked away, that everything the West is doing to Russia right now would be aligned against China if and when China makes a decision to go in on Taiwan. I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and I'm going to use that term because that's what it is, has freed up China's hand. It makes China's military move on Taiwan inevitable. It will happen because now China knows that the West can't do anything. The West has no, the West has played every sanctions card it has against Russia, and it failed. Yeah. The West can't sanction China because that'll be already the weakened Western economy would collapse if they sanction China. The West has no military response at all. Give you an example. Korea. We are in a position to reinforce Korea only because, A, we have 10,000-plus troops permanently stationed there. B, we have pre-positioned stocks of equipment there for Americans to, who are earmarked for Korea to fly in. And C, we train with the Ukrainians all the time. Not the Ukrainians, the South Koreans all the time. So that our military and their military act as one. You know who we don't train with all the, and I'm not talking about, you know, a couple of Marines teaching people how to use a Zodiac boat. We don't train with the Taiwanese. We don't have any strategic relationship with them on the training side. We don't have any troops stationed there permanently. We don't have any troops earmarked to go to Taiwan. Even if they did, what equipment would they fall in on? We don't have pre-positioned equipment. So we have to bring all our equipment there. To get in a Korean War, get 400,000 Americans to Korea is going to take 6 to 9 months. And that's with all the planning in place. To try and get 400,000 troops to Taiwan, it'll never happen because the troops that we'd have to send to Taiwan are earmarked for Korea. Do you really think that we're going to expose Korea like that? Because the 10,000 troops there are purely a tripwire designed to hold until we can reinforce. If we send all the reinforcements to Taiwan, you think North Korea is going to sit there and go, yeah, we're not going to do anything? No. So the West is powerless to stop a Chinese attack on Taiwan. And the Taiwanese, I think, will be just as brave as the Ukrainians, and the end result will be just the same. The total destruction of their island, unnecessary civilian loss, and the Chinese taking control of Taiwan, because they're going to take control of Taiwan. It would have been a much harder decision for Taiwan, for China to make, had Russia not gone into Ukraine. But Russia's kicked that door down. It's no longer the shock that the world now is used to powers like Russia and China taking that which they claim is theirs to take. And Taiwan is China's to take, according to China. Now, China also has an expansive reach in the South China Sea. We see them putting up their man-made islands and reinforcing existing islands. They've created this barrier. Earlier this year, it's come out that they fully militarized this now, meaning it's done. They've got their air defense systems in, their radars in, everything. It's literally a defensive line, which now means China can create some mischief. And one of the areas they're creating mischief is the Solomon Islands. You know, when the United States, and I'll tell you why they're picking the Solomon Islands, because Australia and New Zealand tend to believe that they have control over the Solomon Islands, that the Solomon Island government reports to them. When we saw this with the Solomon Island Prime Minister saying, why do I have to take orders from Auckland? Why do I have to take orders from Australia? I'm the governor. I get to do what I want. The Australians and the United States have been operating under the belief that any military campaign against the South China Sea islands of China would involve American intermediate range missiles that are deployable, meaning you can put them on a C-130 or C-17, fly them to an unimproved airfield, and guess where they've exercised this at? Solomon Island. And they think that the Solomon Islands is their new aircraft carrier, where they can bring these missiles in, land them, offload them, fire them. And China's saying, I don't think so. We're gonna remove that option. And I think that's what China's up to. China is shaping the geopolitical reality in preparation for a potential military conflict. Again, this isn't purely hypothetical. The Chinese ambassador back in the end of January of this year in a press interview with National Public Radio in the United States said, if things keep going the way they're going, military conflict between China and the United States over Taiwan is inevitable. Inevitable. It's going to happen. So China, and the ambassador wouldn't say that unless that was the official position of the Chinese government. So I think that China right now is shaping the future battlefield in the Pacific. There will be a war in the Pacific. Mark my words. China will win this war because it will be a war about Taiwan, which the United States cannot respond to effectively. And any effort to counterattack through the South China Sea will be met with defeat because China's already prepared for it. We haven't. We don't have a response. We're in the middle of trying to shift. And, you know, the beauty of what the Russians did in Ukraine, and I don't think it was coordinated this way, but it's just one of the outcomes, is Biden doesn't want to be in Europe. The last place Biden wants to be is Europe. The last place the American military wanted to go is Europe. We're actually looking at drawing down so we could go to the Pacific. And now Biden is married to Europe, married to NATO, married to spending hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild America's military credibility in Europe. And guess where that money's not going? The Pacific, which makes us even weaker. And, you know, the alliances that we build, the Quad, Japan, India, Australia, the United States, it's not really an alliance. India's not part of it. I mean, they're part of it, but what you know, what's happened here because of Ukraine, India feels like the West is turning on India, getting ready to sanction India. So the Quad may lose one of its biggest members. Then we got this other thing, AUKUS, Australia, UK, United States, which is, a military alliance based upon some notional concept of a nuclear submarine that has yet to emerge. And a nuclear submarine, which even if Australia got all the nuclear submarines they wanted to, are meaningless against China because Australia is a meaningless country against China. I don't know why Australia thinks it has any military credibility whatsoever. It has none. It can't project its power. It's got no power to project. And the UK is what? Going to replay the lesson of the repulse in, I forget the other ship that got sunk.
Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales and the repulse. If the UK sends its fleet back into the South China Sea, they will lose all of their ships. That's just a statement of fact. And the United States knows that its Navy has a zero chance of surviving if it gets in with missile range of China. The fact of the matter is the Chinese have already won the war. It's just a question of when they're going to pull the trigger and make this this victory inevitable. Having a debate, discussion, dialogue about issues like this is so important, and you're not getting it on the mainstream media. So thank you guys for having a platform like this that promotes this kind of interaction. This is good. Well, I'm just going to leave it with this. Look, I have a resume. The resume gives me a certain amount of credibility when I speak on certain issues. But I always ask people when I speak to assume that I'm lying up front. Just assume that what I'm saying is absolute propaganda, garbage, and then go out and research yourself. Don't accept at face value anything I've said here. Research yourself, empower yourself with knowledge and information. If you view this interaction here as a vehicle that causes you to ask questions, causes you to challenge long-held beliefs, etc., then this has been worthwhile. But if you come out of this saying everything Scott Ritter said is the gospel, then all we've done is committed the same sin that mainstream media has committed. And I don't want to be part of that. This is supposed to be, as I said before, about generating debate, discussion, and dialogue about extraordinarily important issues. I have an opinion. I have some facts. I bring those together in what I call informed speculation on many things. But don't take what I say as the Bible. Don't take it as gospel. Just take it as a starting point for your own journey of self-empowerment through the acquisition of knowledge and information. I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Bye-bye.